other one, and the other one exposes the other one, it actually can end up with a sum total of more true stuff on the record than the era of those where a city might have three respectable newspapers all kind of printing variations of the same story. It just is really hard as a newsreader to follow it all and to keep track of what's real and what's false.
Assis, what do you think about the argument for partisan press?
Look, there's subjectivity in journalism and there's objectivity in journalism. What's the subjectivity? It's in what stories you choose to cover. That is totally subjective.
Mm-hmm.
I can be running a mainstream news organization and choose to cover 10 stories today. You could be running another one and choose to cover 10 completely different stories today. That's the subjective part of what we do. But the objective part of what we do should be, once we decide which stories those are that we're going to cover, we have to cover them in a fair and objective and balanced way. We can't let our religions or our corporate allegiances or the fact that we're getting a paycheck from a client color our search for the truth about those stories. That is where objectivity has to kick in, and that's how we should judge the output of any news, any organization that claims to be a news organization. It's on the objectivity of their finished report, not on the subjective. Like if there's a news organization that starts up that says we only want to concentrate on doing stories about the dangers of nuclear power, fine, good, that's great. But it doesn't mean that it gives them the license to distort or manipulate or lie about the messages that they're going to be reporting on. And that's how I try to judge all of these different outlets. So yeah, let 1,000 flowers blossom. You know, look, one of my biggest fears in writing this book is all my friends in PR, and I do have some, a lot of them are former journalists, are going to hate me. In fact, I've got a vigorous exchange going on right now between a former colleague who's in the world of PR. Are they all evildoers? No. But in the end, if you take on clients, your allegiance is to the client.
I've just got to say, because I can't let Jesse get away with saying 1,000 flowers like I let him say it. But I think that there are a lot of skewed reports coming out from media that picks a side. And, you know, I can look at them and see what facts are missing and that there's no balance. And so I don't think that idea that you've got a left media that reports one side of facts, a right media that reports another side of facts, and they all fit down to algorithms that feed us exactly what we want to hear and we never see the other side, is kind of working. So that's my take. Go ahead, Jesse. You wanted to get into this.
Oh, yeah. Because, Cecil, everything you just said except for one thing is wrong. The notion that the objectivity of journalists ends at story selection, I mean, come on. We are subjective in which photograph runs with the story, in the headline, in who we decide to speak to. The most neutral-sounding CP-style report has 100 decisions in it. The use of the passive voice or the active voice, terminology, jargon. This is what we do here every week, is dissect this stuff for its subjectivity.
But the final objective, like you could say the same thing about scientists in a laboratory in terms of the test tubes they're using, what methodology they want to employ, how big is their sample size, what questions are they asking. I mean, in the end, it's a pursuit of truth.
That's the thing you said that was right. The big difference.
See what I put up with every day?
The difference is not between objectivity and subjectivity. The difference is between who's paying you and who do you serve. That's the only difference, right? It's basically, are you doing journalism or not? I think it's totally okay to have information. I wouldn't necessarily call it journalism.
A big thing I talk about in my book is like the conventional narrative. Let's take a couple quick examples that we all know about. The story of the two Michaels. Up until a few days ago, anyone who dared in the media suggest that the two Michaels were anything other than innocent victims of a off-their-rocker Chinese regime that was just trying to use them as bargaining chips to get Meng Wanzhou released would have been laughed at. Suddenly, maybe there's another story here based on a Globe and Mail report. I don't know all the facts yet, but the power of a conventional narrative especially when it deals with who's our adversary. You know, this gets ramped up in times of war.
But do you know the first place that I read about everybody stop glorifying the two Michaels, they're spies? The first place that I read about that was from the very partisan far-left press in Canada. Now, you'll get true things coming from partisan press. What they didn't have was the discipline of journalism. It took Bob Fyfe and Stephen Chase to actually prove that, right?
I wouldn't go that far. I mean, they're relying on an anonymous source. So every time you rely on an anonymous source, the jury is still out.
Well, yeah, to start building a verifiable record that documenting that there's good reason to believe that at least one of them was involved in espionage. My point is we benefit from having many different voices with many different agendas.
I totally agree.
But ultimately, the role of the journalist is to sort through it all because we're the only ones who are using a discipline that answers to what is real as opposed to how can I benefit my master.
That is what I meant by objectivity. And if you want to call it rigor, if you want to call it journalistic integrity, if you want to apply a different label, I'm with you. But the power of the narrative is so great. Like, you know, we all know, of course, that when the U.S. invaded Iraq and accused Saddam Hussein of having weapons of mass destruction, that was a lie. We all know this today. And yet, if you look at what the big American and Canadian media outlets were reporting at the time, they all fell in line with this narrative. I've gone to a lot of journalism conferences. I would bump into American reporters 3, 4, 5 years after that. They felt guilty that they were not pushing back on that at the time.
Can I ask you about that for a minute? Because it's a phenomenon that I'm witnessing again. It's when the moral atmosphere gets so intense around a narrative that we suspend our practice as journalists, where it becomes, you know, a real act of heresy to question, you know. So after 9/11, it was about emotion. It was everyone was feeling so vulnerable and victimized and terrible and vengeful that no one dared say, I don't know about this stuff. You know, it was just you'd have to go against such a kind of monolithic emotional persuasive force to do so. And whenever things get intense enough, it happens again.
You know, it's very true. And look, I have a chapter in my book on the military. The military have hundreds of people on staff devoted to public relations and communications. Did you know that? Hundreds. And there are less than, you can count on the fingers of one hand, the number of full-time mainstream journalists who cover defense in Canada. That's the imbalance there. But I spoke to David Pugliese, who is probably one of Canada's best reporters, in my estimation, and he tries to hold the Defense Department to account quite regularly, routinely. He's got very good sources. He's been accused of being a Taliban supporter, a Russian sympathizer. The minister's office has tried to get him fired on a number of occasions. The pressure to fall into line on certain narratives is great.
They'll tell you that you're killing people. If you find out something, they'll call up your editor and say, if he runs this, it's going to cost Canadian lives. That's what the security apparatus says. It's the first thing they say when they know that you figured something out.
That is totally right. Or take another example. This incident where, you know, all our parliamentarians stood up and cheered for a Waffen SS member in Parliament. If you remember that incident.
Yes, I do.
How did the media respond to that? It happened on a Friday. Not a single mainstream Canadian journalist pointed this out. They all said, oh, in the crowd today is a Ukrainian hero who fought against the Russians in World War II. The first response of Trudeau to that incident.
This is something that is deeply embarrassing to the Parliament of Canada and by extension to all Canadians. I think particularly of Jewish MPs and all members of the Jewish community across the country who are commemorating Yom Kippur today. I think it's going to be really important that all of us push back against Russian propaganda, Russian disinformation, and continue our steadfast and unequivocal support for Ukraine.
He tried to raise the specter of Russian disinformation because that was the strategy the Liberals used when all the stories started surfacing about Chrystia Freeland's grandfather.
We were directly warned, don't take the bait. And it turns out it was true that this was being peddled by Putin affiliates. It was also true that it was true.
Exactly. It was true that it was true. That's the key thing.
It's a daily game, you know. It's a daily operation of trying to divine fact from fiction. And part of it is just that not even about trying to fool the press, but it's just trying to get your message out when the field is very crowded. Every day that the PR flack wants to get a message out there, they're competing with everybody else who wants to get, you know, there's only a limited amount of attention people have. Cecil, thank you very much.
Thank you.
That is your Canada Land. My email address is jesse@canadaland.com. I read everything that you send. Our website is canadaland.com. Our senior producer is Bruce Thorson. Additional production and editing is from Tristan Capicchione. Our managing editor is Annette Ajofor. Our editor-in-chief, who joined me in today's interview, is Karen Pugliese. I'm your host, Jesse Brown. Our theme music is by So-Called. Syndication's handled by CFUV 101.9 FM in Victoria. Visit them online at cfuv.ca. Hi there. You just heard Canada Land, the show where I'm typically joined by a different guest each week for a long feature interview. What you're going to hear next is Canada Land Shortcuts, a topical news show where I'm joined by a different co-host each week, and we talk about the media's coverage of various stories in the news right now. Wait for it.
Hello, I'm Emily Nicola, and welcome to Shortcuts. This week, I'm joined by Mathieu Roach, host of The Backbench. Hello, Mathieu.
Hi, Emily. Good to be on a show that neither of us normally host.
Yeah, no, it's amazing. Usually you're the host, I'm the guest on your show, and now I'm the host on a show that I don't host. It's amazing.
Next, we need to get me on Détour. It'll make me practice my French.
Oh, yes. Great idea. So today we're going to discuss the breaking news out of Gaza, and because everything that's been coming out of Gaza has been, you know, making us think about the media crisis in Canada, we're going to be updating you on what's been going on with that. Welcome to Shortcuts, where we talk shit about the news. So, Mateo, we've been talking about Gaza, and one thing that's always in the background of every conversation about Gaza, and especially media coverage of Gaza, is the crisis of confidence in Western media in general. It's been growing, and I myself, in my own social circles, I've never seen so much conversation about how Western media is broken. I don't know about you.
It's a common theme that comes up among people I know who do not work in the media. Like, it's not just media workers that
exactly.
are talking about it, right?
No, it's everybody that has any kind of concern or interest in the world seems to have frustration with media right now. And so it's not, you know, there's been a lot of conversation, I think, in the past coming from, you know, for example, people who believe in conspiracy theory, who don't believe in facts, who criticize journalism and the kind of, you know, criticism of media that we've been seeing, for example, in the Ottawa convoy and whatnot. That's not what I'm talking about now. Maybe it's a mix of the two. But for example, in Quebec, there was just a Léger poll that found that 42% of the Quebec population has little or no confidence in publications that really news from traditional media. That's 42%. And that 44% of the Quebec population think that traditional media manipulate the information they broadcast. That's a lot. And so that's the context in which we're having a conversation about, is Western media broken? It's a context that resonates with a lot of people. And, you know, there's the obviously Bill C-18 that is affecting this conversation, with the Online News Act that is, you know, taking Canadian media as well away from Facebook and Instagram for now. There's this ongoing tug of war going on with Google as well. How do you think what the federal government has been doing impacting this media crisis?
Not well. I mean, I think the federal government, I will give them like the smallest shred of credit for at least recognizing that there is a media crisis and that something should be done about it. That being said, I think the two big pieces of legislation that we've seen come out that they have tried to use to resolve this issue or sort of ameliorate conditions, which is like the sort of Bill C-11 giving subsidies to journalistic organizations, and then Bill C-18 trying to force tech companies to in some way pay for like whatever revenue they maybe generate through link sharing. Both of them have like kind of completely blown up, right? So I think if people, most people I know, right, I'm 25, like the sort of average age of people in my social circles is, I would say, kind of like 23 to like 33 is sort of where we're at. Most of us do not have newspaper subscriptions, or if, you know, if people do, they have one subscription. Most people do not have cable television, so they're not watching TV news. And so the way that I, for a very long time, got my news was through social media. And it's become just so much more difficult to access really any sort of content that way. I think the other issue, too, is like there's this notion of, well, if government is subsidizing media more, whether this is actually accurate or not, like I don't think that government subsidies of newspapers has necessarily actually resulted in, say, you know, your Toronto Stars, your Globe and Mails, your National Posts being less willing to criticize the government. I haven't seen that direct shift in coverage. But I do think that if you already perhaps are predisposed to distrust traditional media and also know, well, these journalists are being subsidized by the government, you might sort of establish a correlative or causative relationship that may not even be there and say, okay, well, these journalists are bought out. Like, how am I supposed to trust anything that they say? And so I think it's very unfortunate that sort of the two marquee pieces of legislation that this government has rolled out to try and save journalism, quote unquote, have served to, firstly, make people trust journalism less because they feel like journalists are mouthpieces of the government, rightly or wrongly, I think wrongly. And then secondly, to make news more difficult to access because you can't see it in your Google search results, you can't see it on Facebook. And so I'm not sure what exactly the solution is to this crisis of confidence, but it seems like the government has really missed the mark.
Yeah, there's a couple of things what you said, and it goes back to my point of there's media criticism that's coming from the right and the one that's coming from the left, and those are very two different ways of criticizing the media. What you're talking about, you know, media being bought out, I think that many people may have not noticed, but actually there's been an increase just this week in the fall economic statement of Canadian journalism labor tax credit. And so there's going to be retroactively to from January 1st, even now a higher limit of how media companies can get reimbursed for their labor cost per eligible employee. And so they're trying to help the media even more than before because probably of the aftermath of C-18 and just a general economic climate. And so they're doubling down on that in a context where a lot of media companies, and you name a few, are really, really struggling. At the same time, there's also a lot of maybe too little too late on that front. One of the cases that have been making the rounds where I am is TVA, which is a part of the Quebecor news network, has laid off more than 500 employees, which is a third of their workforce here in Quebec. That is a seismic change in terms of media, and they're basically going to be outsourcing a lot of their TV production. And I'm saying this because, you know, except for news, Canadian TV production in general is already, I don't want to say dead, but a lot of, you know, English Canada listens to a lot of American television, right? And so although English Canada is much bigger in terms of numbers, the audience for Francophone television in Canada is actually way bigger than for Anglophone television in Canada. And so if Francophone TV in Canada is not doing well, nobody's doing well, is what I'm trying to say. You know, what they're saying and what's been coming out of that analysis is their viewers are aging, and that kind of like what you were saying, my generation, I'm 35, I'm 10 years older than you, are not watching necessarily television the way that Gen X and boomers are watching it, and Gen Z definitely not at all. And part of that is it's just users having different habits, and part of it is just how society has changed and media haven't followed. We've just seen some really interesting data coming out this week from the Canadian Association of Journalists in terms of how white Canadian media still are, and that's part of it. But I guess my generation, your generation, are just also not necessarily finding themselves represented in Canadian media, and that really does not help with people wanting to consume that content. And that's a very, very different way of criticizing Canadian media than saying, well, they're bought off by the government and it's all a big conspiracy because it cannot criticize the government anymore. Right? So that's just a very different thing.
I would be interested to know, like looking at the CAJ data, I don't think that they collected data, at least not that I saw, on like the age of people working in newsrooms or certainly of like TV anchors as well. Because I know that that's one thing that I notice is I feel like a lot of the broadcasters that I watch, I really only ever watch broadcast TV if I'm like at my mom's house because she'll put on the sort of local news or whatever. I notice that a lot of the broadcasters that I'm watching are like the same people that were doing the news, you know, 15 years ago when I was like 10 and first started watching it. There's some turnover that you sometimes see, but I think that there's a certain notion that I feel, at least among people that I know, that there's a real like lack of variety in terms of voices that you actually get on cable news, that you see really sort of like one perspective, even if maybe the specific person who's delivering you the news changes. There are sort of two sorts of coverage that I want to see more of. One is like in-depth local journalism. And I think that if the government is going to fund news, that is the type of news that makes the most sense for them to fund. Because then at that point, you're funding journalists who likely are not primarily covering the federal government. They might be covering municipal or provincial community issues. And so that sort of perceptual issue is a bit less acute in terms of like, oh, well, they're receiving money from this group that they're supposed to cover. Obviously, local journalists also do cover the federal government, but it's often not their main beat. That's something I would like to see more of, that I feel like when I am in Nova Scotia, the coverage that is available of news in the province is often not that good, which I find quite upsetting. And then the other thing that I'd want to see more of is really, yeah, like a better diversity of voices nationally, right? Because, you know, most of the journalists I imagine that CAJ was counting in this survey are reporting in communities that are not like super majority white. They're reporting in like Vancouver, Toronto, Montreal, places that are much more diverse. So even if the sort of demographics and data maybe match the whole profile of the country, they don't match the cities in which these journalists are working. And I think that that's a problem.
Yeah, no, that's a good thing. If you want to go and check out the Canadian Association of Journalists survey, one of the things that they've included in their methodology is proportion of diversity versus their audience. And so if a media is Toronto-based, their overrepresentation of or underrepresentation of certain demographics that factored in that they're actually working in Toronto. And you can see that, you know, they've gathered data from 273 newsrooms across the country. You say that over half of newsroom staff identify as women. So in terms of gender equality, we're pretty much there, although we need to look into the details in terms of, you know, who's higher up. But that there's still 3/4 of journalists who identify as white, 19% as visible minority, 5% as indigenous. And that when you climb up the ladder, you know, when it comes to supervisors in Canadian media, then 84% of them are white. I have to say, Mattea, because, you know, I'm from Quebec, that basically there's hardly any newsroom that's based in Montreal that has, first of all, agreed to participate in the CAJ survey. That's in and of itself an issue. I know that there's the FPGQ and we have our own journalism association, but it's not doing a survey like this. And so there's just Quebec media refusing to participate. La Presse has participated. And the result is that when you look at their full-time staff, 98% of them are white. So basically there's like 140 people that are working at La Presse, more or less. There's one black person, two Middle Eastern person, and everybody else is white. And the Devoir has refused to participate, but if they had, they would not look any better. And I'd be very curious in terms of, you know, radio and TV. And so when I'm saying that, you know, of course, TVA is having an audience that is aging and younger population are not necessarily finding themselves in Quebec journalism and in Quebec media. That's the kind of data that we're looking at. It's appalling that that's where still we're at in 2023. And the refusal to collect data and to participate in such a survey is not working in terms of hiding the issue, because I'm on it and you're on it, Mattea. So we see the people who just refuse to participate because they're just ashamed of their own data. It's not working. We still see you guys.
And I think, you know, it to kind of circle back, I guess, to tie the two segments of this show together, like it really does then make you think of like, well, what is not being said in these organizations' coverage because of who is not in the room, right? What questions are not being asked in those rooms? what guests are not being booked because people don't have connections with certain communities. You know, it's no surprise then that you're going to see in a lot of cases coverage that is one-sided of issues that predominantly affect, like, say, racialized communities. I can't even imagine what it would be like to be the one Black person or the one of the two Middle Eastern people working at La Presse. To have to be sort of the sole voice for your community in that space just sounds unbelievably unpleasant.
I guess that's
that's life.
Meet me, Mattia.
You are stronger than the troops. We are so lucky to have you in our space.
Thank you. Although because I'm a freelance worker, I work in with Civil Newsroom, but I don't count in any of the stats.
You're not helping their data look any better.
I'm just watching the numbers and eating some popcorn.
Yep.
Before we end, I just wanted to maybe point out, because we've been pretty bleak so far. So there is one thing that makes me hopeful in terms of how people are responding to the media crisis. There's a new online platform that's just been launched that's called Unrigged. And it's basically a coalition or a cooperative of 20 local, regional, and national media outlets, pretty much from the left, that have decided to build basically an umbrella website. There's Press Progress, there's Bar Patch, there's The Hoser, there's New Brunswick Media Co-op, The Breach, Resolve, Ricochet, and Maple. There's a lot of them. Pivot here in Quebec. So there's a couple of news organizations that maybe didn't have the capacity to be publishing every day, or that it's a lot of work if you're going to go on each of those people, you know, website to have a sense of what's going on in local news in Canada. But that now, because they've decided to aggregate, it's actually a pretty useful tool I found so far in terms of being able to just go to one place and find local news from both Alberta and New Brunswick and Quebec and Ontario from independent newsroom. So just wanted to flag that that's a way that people have found around, for example, the ban on social media that is really impacting the reach a lot of Canada's smaller newsroom. And so, yeah, it's not just bleak out there. There are some people who are trying to figure this out.
Yeah, I really hope it takes off because, you know, like, again, for me, living and working in Toronto, but trying to follow news in Nova Scotia and on the East Coast more broadly, I find it's often very difficult to get any sort of high quality news to, like, make sure that it breaks through even on my Twitter feed if I'm following journalists or following news organizations. And then the other thing, too, is for me, you know, hosting a show that is federal and trying to pay attention to what's happening in other parts of Canada, there are so many ways in which, like, the crises that we're facing in different parts of the country that feel very regional are actually, like, super tied to things that are happening in other places. If you look at, for instance, like, how provincial governments are having to deal with climate crises, whether it's flooding or wildfires, like, that's an issue where there are very specific local stories that are of particular concern to the communities in which they're taking place, but that people in the rest of Canada really should know about and, like, learn from, because, you know, 1 month it's Nova Scotia, next month it's BC, right? The parental rights thing is, like, another issue where we've seen sort of local coverage pop up of, like, in New Brunswick, the government there really going hard on, you know, we need to out kids to their parents in schools, essentially.
Right.
That's what parental rights means, I suppose, to the conservatives there. And it's not just New Brunswick, right? You then see that discourse kind of cropping up. And if you're only really getting local news in bits and spurts from the place that you live, you're not going to see those connections. And so to have a platform that really is integrating coverage from all different parts of the country, I think could be really useful in ensuring that people stay informed, not just about their own community, but about communities really everywhere.
That's Shortcuts this week. Thank you for joining me. I'm Emilie Nicolas, and obviously you can join us on Twitter at CanadaLand and email me about the show at emilie@canadaland.com. Where can people find you, Mathieu?
You can find me on The Backbench, which is CanadaLand's federal politics show. We release episodes every 2 weeks on Tuesdays, so our next one will be coming up this Tuesday, November 28th. You can also find me on Twitter, not tweeting that much, but still there, at Mathieu Roach.
This episode is produced by Aviva Lessard, with additional production by Caleb Thompson. Our managing editor is Anita Joffa. Our editor-in-chief is Karen Pugliesi. Theme music is by So-Called. Syndication is by CFUV 101.9 FM in Victoria. Visit them online at cfuv.ca.
Stop. Starting from the week of Monday, May 30th, the Student Union Building is open 7 days a week from 9 a.m. to 10 p.m. The sub-building common spaces, along with the bookable spaces, are available for use. Any comments or questions, please go to the Simon Fraser Student Society website at sfss.ca for more information.